ஓம் ஜனனியம் சாரதாம் தேவீம் ராமகிருஷ்ணம் ஜெகத்குரு பாதபத்மே தயோ சித்வ பிரணமாமி முகர்முக. ஸோ டுடே ஐ எம் டீலிங் வித் த சென்ட்ரல் டாபிக் இன் தி லைட் ஆஃப் எ இலஸ்ட்ரேஷன், எ மோஸ்ட் விவிட் இலஸ்ட்ரேஷன் ஆஃப் ஹோலி மதர்ஸ் யூனிவர்சல் லவ் expressed in mother child relationship. Now most of you know about Sister Nivedita, Margaret Noble. She was born in Ireland. She was not familiar with any of India's traditional culture or spiritual heritage. She came in contact with Swami Vivekananda, became his disciple. Now, how she was treated as a daughter, as a child, by Holy Mother. It's a very vivid description in one of the articles, which I am going to read and then we will discuss. This particular book begins with a quotation from Sri Ramakrishna. Sri Ramakrishna once told Mother, "I went to a place where all the people were white. How sincere their devotion was." Says Sri Ramakrishna to Sri Sharada Devi as she emerged from Samadhi. Mother related this incident to imply that they would have many foreign devotees. She said, "At that time, I could not even imagine that there would be foreign devotees. I was at a loss to think who these white people might be." Now you have to remember, Sri Ramakrishna was living in Dakshineswar temple and he had a vision that in future many people born in foreign lands will be drawn towards his spiritual instructions. Now here is, we have a picture of Margaret Noble, who later became Sister Nivedita. Born in Ireland, Margaret Elizabeth Noble went to India in January 1898 in response to Swami Vivekananda's call to be of service to the women of India. So Nivedita met Swami Vivekananda and was completely transformed into a great devotee and a great lover of Vedantic tradition, Vedantic heritage. And later she went to India and she had a direct contact with Holy Mother. And when she went to Holy Mother, she had a wonderful transformation. So she wrote to Mrs. Nell Hammond. Nivedita is here writing about her impression, her experience at the presence of Mother. She said, Nivedita described Mother's life as one long stillness of prayer because she keenly observed that her outer life of efficiency and service was always balanced by an inner life of realization and renunciation. All round gongs are beating and bells are ringing, for it is the time for evening worship, Nivedita is writing. The women in the zenana prostrate before a sacred picture of an image, and then it is the use of Sri Sarada Devi's household, which is really a convent, to go to meditation. Mother was living in Udbodhan, the place built by Swami Saradananda for her residence. For an hour or two, you will see some of the women counting their rosaries quietly while the mother sits chanting, chatting with anyone who is there. Now, who was this Sister Nivedita? She was an Irish lady, a well-educated, kind of a firebrand. And, you know, that was a time of political agitations in Ireland. She was drawn towards many of these political and nationalistic ideologies. It was during those days that she happened to listen to Swami Vivekananda. And she accompanied Swami Vivekananda to India, had long dialogues with Swamiji, used to argue with Swamiji, and used to question some of the traditional Vedantic Hindu customs. Nivedita constantly argued with Swami Vivekananda, whereas she could not argue with Mother. That's what author writes. Now, how can you argue with your mother? Because mother was using only one tool in her hands to teach her, not disciple, but child, and that is love. So you cannot argue with somebody who cannot be drawn into an argument, because Nivedita found that mother was not looking upon her as a disciple or a student, but rather as a child. Here I should say a few things about the traditional Vedantic concept of cyclicism, what you call cyclic evolution of individual life. It is said in Vedanta and also in the Patanjali's yoga philosophy that we get drawn to an alien culture or tradition in a particular way when we feel that we are continuing a journey from previous life. Because when we travel from life to life, we carry with us a bundle of tendencies, samskaras and impressions. So they become very prominent. And in the next life, when the external circumstances present identical samskaras and impressions, then our mind responds to that. This was repeated on a few earlier occasions. In the 6th chapter of Gita, Arjuna discusses this point, and Lord Krishna gives a description of this phenomenon. Arjuna puts a very simple question to Krishna. Suppose we meditate, we pray, we do japa for a long time, for several years, and then we don't succeed or we don't feel that we are making enough progress. Now, what happens? And some people die before they reach their spiritual goal. They reach the highest spiritual enlightenment. Now, Arjuna is putting a question which apparently corresponds to the Abrahamic, the perspective of life in Abrahamic traditions. Means life is only just one journey. You start from beginning, from birth, you move and you end with death. Death is a full stop, the end of the journey. That's what Arjuna had perhaps in mind. Now, Arjuna asked this question. Don't you think that all our efforts will go in vain if we don't succeed before we die, before we pass out? Now, Krishna's response is simple. He says, whatever you do in this life will not be lost. So even a little bit of spiritual practice that we do in this life will be effective, will be fruitful and useful, and it will remain there as a spiritual capital that we'll be able to make use of in next life. So, while explaining this phenomenon, Lord Krishna says the 6th chapter, Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade paura dekhikam Yatateja tato bhuya samsiddho kurunantena. This is a verse, a very famous verse, which practically gives in a nutshell the whole phenomenon of transcultural migration of life from transcultural, transcontinental migration of individual jivas from life to life. What Krishna says is this. In this life, we accumulate certain tendencies and impressions which constitute the character. But we have accumulated diverse tendencies and impressions and samskaras which constitute a bundle of conflicting ideas, tendencies, impressions, impulses, etc. And then what happens? In the next life, when we find ourselves in a situation where an external situation which prompts the re-emergence of this accumulated samskaras, then they come to the surface and they connect and we feel drawn towards a spiritual ideal. So the mechanism as given in the Patanjali system and also in Vedantic system, especially in the Sankhya and the teachings of Gita is simple. Whatever we do consciously will create a vritti or a modification in the mind stuff which we call chittam. Let's say call it mind to be simple. So whatever we do, we speak or think or even a flash thought will create a modification in the mind stuff. So mind stuff is nothing but a bundle of diverse modifications and vrittis and tendencies created. Now each modification is like ripple, will become a tendency. If it is related to a pleasant experience, we will have a tendency, an inclination to continue that. If it is related to an unpleasant experience, we will have a tendency to avoid it. So an action produces a modification. Modification becomes a tendency. Tendency may be called a samskara. A tendency becomes a vasana. Vasana is nothing but a samskara which is action-oriented. When you have a strong tendency, then that tendency creates an impulse for acting out that tendency, to act according to that tendency. So action, modification, tendency, that is called samskara, vasana, and vasana again will prompt us to take a decision to act accordingly, which is called sankalpa, and sankalpa will again create karma or action, action will again produce modification. So this cycle continues. So when we feel a strong inclination towards something, it means we have done that work, that act, or we have thought. If we feel a strong inclination towards a particular thought system, a samskara, we have done something that produces the samskara, if not in this life, next life. If we feel conflict, if we feel difficulties, then it means two mutually conflicting samskaras are hitting at each other, which is the result, which is the reason for conflicts. And very often feel we want to meditate, we take a decision, we read books, tomorrow on which I will pray, meditate. We cannot do that. At the time, well, something else, well, something else I will do rather tomorrow. So procrastination and postponement are supposed to be the most common manifestations of these conflicts between mutually opposing types of samskaras. We find a justification for not doing something. Actually, mind is projecting a conflicting tendency, which takes the form of an excuse for not doing that. Now, what I was telling earlier was, this cycle moves on like this. That means action, modification, tendency, vasana, sankalpa, decision, willpower. Again, that leads to action. The cycle continues like that. Now, in the case of Sister Niveda, for example, how she felt that she was sitting right in the presence of her own mother when she felt Holy Mother. Holy Mother, in terms of culture, language, traditions, customs, in everything, totally different. Mother couldn't speak, couldn't understand one word of what Sister Nivedita could speak. Sister Nivedita, Margaret Noble, couldn't understand one word of Bengali, which alone mother could speak. Now, what was the spiritual mechanism which functioned, which automatically solved all the conflicts and problems which Sister Nivedita was facing? In fact, that's why she used to argue with Swami Vivekananda. You find long descriptions of Sister Nivedita's conversations with Swami Vivekananda. She asked many questions. Swamiji tries to solve some of those questions. Swamiji and Sister Nivedita were functioning at the intellectual level. To some extent, of course, Swamiji used his spiritual power to transform her. But in the presence of mother, there was no argument, there was no logic, there was no reasoning. She felt that she was in the presence of a person who was a greater mother than her own biological mother. And all her doubts, conflicts completely resolved. So, Nivedita had at last discovered the ideal Indian woman. She found her to be the manifestation of motherhood with a universal outlook. Now, as I said yesterday, the relationship between a mother and child is the most intimate, the most informal. True, but even there is an element of, lopsidedness. So every mother thinks that her child is a genius. Suppose two children fight living in neighborhood. And mostly, except highly enlightened mothers, the mother of one child will justify, will defend her child. And this often happens the other way also. So even in this purest and most sublime and intimate human relationship, there is an element of selfishness, well, that may not be the proper word to use, at least limitation, limitedness. But in the case of Holy Mother, Holy Mother's motherhood, motherliness was a universe, the motherliness of a universal mother. So she found her to be the manifestation of motherhood with a universal outlook. So she writes to her friend Mrs. Radcliffe, "Our Holy Mother, as we call her, is only a simple Hindu woman. Yet, as I think, the greatest woman in the world today." Within 2 months of Nivedita's first meeting with Mother, she had described her as one of the strongest and greatest women, and almost within a period of only 5 years, her outlook changed, "the greatest woman in the world today." Now, you had to remember, Mother could hardly understand her language. She gradually, of course, picked up Bengali language, but didn't become so conversant. But still, you find this is how the spiritual motherhood functions, because it doesn't recognize any boundaries of language, culture, nationality, ethnicity, or anything. It is so universal. Nivedita always loved to be in Mother's company, in whose calm presence she became transformed into an innocent 5-year-old child wholly dependent on her mother. She would take a mat and kiss it over and over again, and then dust it with great care before spreading it on the floor for mother. One of the disciples of mother wrote, "Seeing her, one felt that her life's purpose had been fulfilled by being able to offer this small service to mother." Nivedita writes, "To me, it has always appeared that she is Sri Ramakrishna's final word as to the ideal of Indian womanhood. But is she the last of an old order or the beginning of a new?" You find, if you read Nivedita's Cradle Tales of Hinduism, you find her describing many of the mythological Puranic concepts of Hindu motherhood. She speaks about, she writes about Dhruva, for example, and innumerable other characters. And she writes about Gargi, Maitreyi. Gargi and Maitreyi were ancient women philosophers of the Vedic period. Both are mentioned in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which belongs to Yajurveda. And if you want to know about Sister Nivedita's ideal of mother, you can read in the Cradle Tales of Hinduism her description of Dhruva and his mother Suniti. You find it's a story taken from a Hindu devotion classic, Bhagavata Purana. In the fourth book of Bhagavata Purana, in five chapters, there is a long description of a small boy. The name of the boy was Dhruva. She was born a prince. His father had two wives. Dhruva's mother was Suniti, where she was a great woman, the typical, the archetypal Hindu mother. A real mother is supposed to look after her children. At the same time, is supposed to become impartial and never try to take side in any domestic conflict. Again, that idea is brought out in this description in five chapters, from 8th chapter to 12th chapter in the Bhagavata Purana. You find it in the fourth section, it's called Skandha, fourth section. From chapter 8 to chapter 12, you find the little boy Dhruva, he was ill-treated by his stepmother, Sudichi, the younger wife of his father, King Uttanavada, and she didn't allow him to sit on the lap of his father. It was a 4-year-old, 5-year-old child. And he was upset. He came crying, weeping to his mother, Suniti, the elder wife or the mother of Dhruva, and told her, "See, my stepmother ill-treated me." Now Suniti says, "Don't find fault with your stepmother. Everyone has to reap the fruits of his own karma. So if you want to find a solution, if you find a solution to your grief, then you pray to God. You turn to God." And she blesses him, this little child, to go to forest, sit in a hermitage and pray to God, meditate on God. That's the instruction given by Suniti to the little child. So she is considered to be one of the archetypal mothers of Hindu heritage. Means a tragedy becomes a boon. A domestic problem becomes a means for a little child become a saint. And he realized, he went to forest, he meditated and realized God. He had a vision of Vishnu within 6 months. That's how the story ends. So Nivedita later on writes all these stories. You can find, and mother actually refers to this. Mother tells Nivedita, "I heard that you are spreading all these great ideas in Europe, and it is very good." Like that, mother appreciates her. So that's why, keeping all this mind, Sister Nivedita writes, she is the typical archetypal mother. The mother who is a good mother to her children, at the same time, her motherliness transcends the immediate domestic sitting. That's right. So Nivedita writes, I have never known her to hesitate in giving utterance to large and generous judgment, however new or complex may be the question put before her. Her whole experience is of theocratic civilization, yet she rises to the height of every situation. Is she tortured by the perversity of any other about her? The only sign is a strange quiet and intensity that comes upon her. Does one carry to her some perplexity or mortification born of social developments beyond her ken? With unerring intuition, she goes straight to the heart of the matter and sits the questioner in the true attitude of difficulty. Now, here, the sister Medhida is referring to one uncanny skill that Holy Mother had. Her universal love enabled her not only to train her spiritual disciples in spiritual life, but also enabled her to become a source of inspiration and guidance to Ramakrishna order of monks. After Sri Ramakrishna's passing away, Holy Mother was not just a spiritual guru of the monastic order. She was practically the final refuge for all people who had faced some problem, including even administrative problems. In many cases, when there were some tricky administrative problems, many of the senior monks, the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna, referred to Holy Mother, and she gave some suggestions. She didn't have a PhD in management science, but with that natural intuitive skill that comes to a person who is an embodiment of universal love, she could go right to the heart of the matter, of the problem, and give a solution. That's what Sister Niveda is referring to. In November 1898, another great disciple, of course, an admirer of Holy Mother, she was an American woman, a great devotee, said to Mother, "Mother, I wish to take your photograph to America and worship it." Sarah Bull writes to Holy Mother, "Mother, I wish to take your photograph to America and worship it." She agreed and all the necessary arrangements were made. Two photographs were taken of Mother and one more with Sister Nivedita sitting facing her. It seemed to signify the holy confluence of East and West. Now here is a letter from Mother addressed to Sister Nivedita. In June 1899, Nivedita's school had to be closed temporarily due to financial stringency. Nivedita started a school in Calcutta for girls. That's what she's speaking about. And then there's a letter addressed by Mother to Sister Nivedita. "May this letter carry all blessing. My dear love to you, baby daughter Nivedita, I am so glad to learn you have prayed to the Lord for my eternal peace. You are a manifestation of the ever-blissful Mother. I look at your photo, which is with me, every now and then, and it seems as if you are present with me. I long for the day and the year when you shall return. May the prayers you have uttered for me from the heart of your pure virgin soul be answered. I am well and happy. I always pray to the Lord that He might help you in your noble efforts and keep you strong and happy. I too pray for your quick return. May He fulfill your desires about the women's home in India, and may that would-be home fulfill its mission in teaching true Dharma to all." Nivedita always felt like a child in the company of Mother. During her visit to the West, in spite of all the difficult times that she had to pass through, her mind used to be constantly engaged in the thought of Mother and impatiently wanted to get some news about her. Being in constant touch with Mother, Nivedita felt secure, like a bird in its nest after a hard day's toil. She wrote elsewhere that after meeting mother, she always felt that she was in the company of a spiritual teacher who was slowly taking her hand and guiding her through the difficult trials and tribulations of her life. And she said once that it's not that I'm holding mother's hand, but it is mother who is holding my hand so that I would not fall. Elsewhere she writes, during her visit to the West, in spite of all the difficult times that she had to pass through, her mind used to be constantly engaged in the thought of mother and impatiently wanted to get some news about her. Being in constant touch with mother, Nivedita felt secure, like a bird in its nest after a hard day's toil, because mother was always holding her hands. Her frequent letters from London prove how much she yearned to get back to India to be with Holy Mother. She wrote to Miss McLeod, "To think of your being so sensible and Calcutta so lucky, and you will be in time to be with Holy Mother. Oh, I am so pleased to think that you will see the Holy Mother." This is from McLeod. There is a small section of the article. The subtopic is "The Power to Penetrate." Nivedita wrote about mother's broad outlook. She writes, "In nothing, perhaps, speak more loudly than in her instant power to penetrate a new religious feeling or an idea. It is said that whenever mother instructed Nivedita, mother could see in her mind her whole life, her past and her present, and also her future." That's what Nivedita wrote later. Nivedita was spiritually formally initiated by Swami Vivekananda. But the first thing that Swamiji did when she reached India was to direct her to Holy Mother. Because Swamiji knew perhaps that a woman like Sister Nivedita, Margaret Noble, with an entirely different cultural and education background, can understand the depth of spirituality only in the presence of a person in whom she could find her own mother. So that's why she is referring to. "In nothing, perhaps, speak more loudly," there are a few dots here, "than in her instant power to penetrate a new religious feeling or an idea." So whatever mothers told her came from her understanding of Sister Nivedita's past, because a great spiritual teacher understands very well the path followed by his or her disciple in the past lives. So what was the spiritual practice that that disciple was following in the past life? And what is her present state of fitness? And what would be the most appropriate instruction that would be helpful to her in her present life? So mother could see all these at one glance. That's what she is writing about. "I first realized this gift of Holy Mother on the occasion of a visit that she paid us in recent years on the afternoon of a certain Easter day. After going over our whole house, the mother and her party expressed a desire to rest in the chapel and hear something of the meaning of Christian festival. This was followed by Easter music and singing with our small French organ. And in the sweetness of her comprehension and the depth of her sympathy with these resurrection hymns, unimpeded by any foreignness or unfamiliarity in them, we saw revealed for the first time one of the most impressive aspects of the great religious culture of Holy Mother Sharada Devi. The saying power is seen to a certain extent in all the women about her who were touched by the hand of Sri Ramakrishna. But in her it was all the strength and certainty of some high and arduous form of scholarship. You find in later writings, I don't have time to refer to that. So on one occasion, it seems that Holy Mother happened to hear some of the hymns, psalms, song during the Christian festival, the Catholic liturgy, the festivals and all that, Christmas songs and all that. Now, Sister Nivedita refers to one interesting phenomenon. When Mother heard these psalms, hymns, sung by the British or American women who were celebrating Christmas, Mother appreciated it so much that they could see that though everything was so unfamiliar to her, she appeared to fully understand the sanctity, the spiritual significance of these psalms. Now, this is not really possible at the empirical human level. This is possible only at the spiritual level, because spirituality and universal motherhood transcend cultural, religious, ethnic boundaries. So when Mother heard this Easter music that was being played by these faithful Christians, she could enjoy it as much as any Christian, because spirituality goes beyond religious diversities. Spirituality in its pure form is universal, and Mother was the very embodiment of spirituality. So she could appreciate the spiritual content of a religious music which was totally unfamiliar to her and which was perhaps totally incomprehensible and unintelligible to her. But the spiritual content transcends the words, the customs, the religious traditions, because it is essentially universal. That is what is mentioned here. After going over whole house, Mother and her party expressed a desire to rest in the chapel and hear something of the meaning of the Christian festival, Easter Day. This was followed by Easter music and singing with our small French organ. And in the swiftness of her comprehension and the depth of her sympathy with these resurrection hymns, unimpeded by any foreignness or unfamiliarity in them, we saw revealed for the first time one of the most impressive aspects of the great religious culture of Sharada Devi, the transcendental, universal, spiritual aspect which does not recognize the boundaries of religion, custom, race, culture, or nationality. That's what she's writing about. The same trait came out again one evening when, in the midst of her little circle, the Holy Mother asked my Guru Bhagini, spiritual sister, and myself to describe to her a European wedding with much fun and laughter, personating now the Christian Brahmin and again the bride and the bridegroom. We complied, but we were neither of us prepared for the effect of the marriage vow. Especially the marriage vow that is part of the Catholic wedding custom. For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, till death us do part. Means that sanctity of the institution of marriage. Now, of course, here we have to remember this is a reference to the traditional Christian wedding vow. You'll be surprised. In the Rigveda Samhita, in the 10th mandala, there is one sukta. Sukta is a hymn which has got innumerable verses. It is called Vivaha Sukta. Vivaha means the hymn of wedding. In the Rigveda Samhita, it begins like this. Remember, I had to memorize all this, so it comes to my memory. So that I think I'm never a priest. So the point is, Grinhamite Saubhagatvaya Hastam. That's how it begins. So, practically, in many of the ancient cultures and traditions, the sanctity and the purity of the institution of marriage and family relationship. When mother who was born and brought up in a traditional culture, which had this ideal as the basis, when she listened to Eastern music and also to the Christian vows of wedding, she could see that similarity. She could appreciate the sanctity of the institution of marriage in a totally different alien culture. Not alien to her, of course, because before mother, all children are the same. There is no difference in culture, tradition, or the race or anything. But still, from a relative empirical point of view, all these things are totally different and totally distinct from anything that she had ever seen or experienced earlier in her own village home, village background. But spirituality and motherhood transcend all these barriers of distinctions and differences of culture, tradition, and everything. So when she listened to this marriage vow, she could appreciate the spiritual content in that. Because every sacred institution has an element of spirituality in it. But none appreciated them as did the mother herself. Again and again she had them repeated to her. The same wedding vow had to be repeated again and again because she wanted to listen to that. Oh, dharmic words, the righteous words. In Vedic tradition, a wife is a fellow pilgrim in the whole process of life. So that is called Sahadharmani, the one who takes half responsibility for the pilgrimage towards the destination. So the spiritual partnership, the ideal of spiritual partnership, she could see in this marriage wedding vow of Catholic tradition. So mother wanted to listen to that again and again. Now you have to remember, mother was not participating in interfaith dialogue or anything, mind you. She didn't know anything about Christian tradition, Islamic tradition, or any tradition other than her own simple village tradition. It's a typical Hindu Orthodox tradition prevailing in the particular part of the country. But still she could see the spiritual content and she could appreciate and respect the spiritual content in it. So she says, oh, the dharmic words, dharma means the words of righteousness, the words of truth, the words of morality. Dharma, words steeped in the principles of dharma. The righteous words, she said. Mother, on her part, accepted the entire universe within her fold. Though she almost lived in seclusion from the outer society, unlike Ramakrishna. Practically, she was all the time living within her own way. Lajja Padavade Nityam in the Abhedanandaji's song, you find. She was always confined within the limits of her own way, but within that world, she could condense the whole universe through her universal love. Once when Nivedita was invited by her Muslim students to lecture on Islam in Asia. At a public hall, Mother expressed her extreme joy when she was told about it. On 29 September, Nivedita wrote, "It's beautiful to go into her, sitting with her women, disciples around her in the evenings. Her voice is as young and her laugh as happy as 11 years ago. And every moment is beautiful, nor is there a grey hair yet." Whenever Sister Nivedita went to her, Mother would make her sit by her side, and there was no bar to the exchange of genuine feelings. She looked upon her as the embodiment of motherhood. A yearning love that can never refuse us, a benediction that forever abides with us, a presence from which we cannot go away, a heart in which we are all always safe, sweetness unfathomed, bond unbreakable, holiness without a shadow, all this indeed and more is motherhood. I will just read a few of Mother's teachings, and then we will have interaction. One instruction that Mother gave more than once, used to repeat again and again, is this: repeat the name of God in the innermost core of your heart, and in all sincerity, take refuge in the Master. Do not bother to know how your mind is reacting to things around, and do not waste time in calculating and worrying whether or not you are progressing in the path of spirituality. It is ahankara to judge progress for oneself. Have faith in the grace of your Guru and Ishta. So an important instruction given by Mother is, we need not always go about measuring what progress we have made in spiritual life. Mother says, it's a waste of time trying to calculate and judge and measure the amount of progress we have made in spiritual life. That's a very, very practical suggestion. We often feel that we have not made enough progress, that we should work hard. What Mother says is, disregarding all these conflicting thoughts that may emerge in the mind, we must focus on continually doing spiritual practice. That's an interesting instruction. Then Mother says, there are devotees who surrender themselves to God but do not practice austerities. Will they attain to this state of realization? The disciple is putting this question to Mother. There are devotees who surrender themselves to God but do not do anything. Then Mother's reply is this: that they surrender themselves to God, that they live placing implicit trust in God, is their spiritual discipline. The point is, complete surrender itself is possible to a few fortunate devotees. Without making some progress in spiritual life, it is impossible even to take seriously the ideal of complete surrender. Therefore, Mother says, if one surrenders completely to God and then forgets about everything else, not trying to judge or calculate or measure the amount of progress we have made, but continually trying to practice again and again, that is enough. That is Mother's instruction. Another instruction. Mother says, God is like a child. You know, he denies some who seek and of himself gives to some who do not. Perhaps some Such people are highly evolved souls from their previous lives. That's why they receive His grace. So, disciple, then distinctions are made even in the matter of grace, mother. Certainly, it's all according to one's karma. Once the bonds of karma are broken, one realizes God. Mother, I admit that spiritual exercise, exhaustion of past karma and proper time, all these are factors in the attainment of spiritual knowledge. But if God is our own, why should He not show Himself out of His grace? That is right, mother says. But who has this faith that He is His own? All take up religion as a matter of form. How many really want to realize God? Here's an interesting topic which frequently devotees ask. It's worthy of discussion. Now, mother says God is like a child. Sometimes God... Now, Sri Ramakrishna, the gospel, refers to this phenomenon. God is sometimes compared to a little boy, little child, who is playing with a toy. Now, if a stranger comes and asks the child, give me that toy that you are playing with. Sometimes the child, no, I won't give you. He may not give that toy to his own or her own mother, sister, brother. But if a total stranger comes and asks, the child may well try to take it. Because a child's actions are not judged by reason, logic, or any kind of any kind of logic that we can analyze by. Now, this is the comparison that you find in the gospel. Now, mother also says the same thing. We also sometimes ask the question. See, some people make rapid progress in spiritual life. We never find them praying, meditating or anything. But they appear to make rapid progress. Here I am praying day and night and nothing is happening. So many people ask this question. This is a very common subject discussed in spiritual classics. See, the answer is very simple. We make all these observations looking at the tip of the iceberg. Our eyes are focused on the tip of the iceberg, which is this life. The iceberg may be 100 feet tall, so huge. Only 10 feet may be visible above the water level. 90 feet is within the water, below the water level, which is invisible to us. Similarly, when we make these observations that some people are making rapid progress and I am not making any progress though I am working very hard, we do not take into consideration the possibility of previous lives. The person who is apparently making rapid progress, I've been working hard for several lives in the past, and in this life he didn't have to do much, so he made rapid progress. In our case, we have started journey, so we have to work hard. Well, if you take this angle, who is old and who is young? He may be 90-year-old, and a child, a 10-year-old child, was perhaps 90-year-old when you were 80 years old. And he passed away and born again, he is now 10 years old. So where do we stand in this cosmic cycle? Neither old age nor youth. So neither progress nor degradation. So it's a continuous journey. Now, mother doesn't refer to this phenomenon, but there are some other context where mother referred. See, that devotee, that person you are referring to, was working hard for several lives in the past. In this life, he didn't have to work so much because he had attained so much in the past. And in your case, you have just started your journey. That's why you are finding obstacles in spiritual life, which we should take into consideration the whole phenomenon of the whole iceberg, the phenomenon of existence. That's the description here. Now we will have interaction, general interaction, not necessarily based on what I read today. It can be based on what we discussed today. You can have today the last day, of course, of the retreat. So any of you?
Oh. Swami, yesterday you, in the afternoon, you told the story of Girish taking refuge with Sri Ramakrishna. And I believe you said that if you sincerely take refuge in God, your will aligns with that of God.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about what taking refuge looks like in a practical way?
Yeah, yes. Now, when we take complete refuge in God, then our whole thought world will be focused on the God idea. There are six characteristics mentioned in the science of total surrender in devotional philosophy. First one is filling the mind with positive thoughts, avoiding all negative thoughts, then complete faith that God will protect me, and accepting God as the sole refuge, and then an aversion towards body consciousness that stands in the way of our total resignation, surrender to God, and finally surrendering ourselves to God's will. These are the six disciplines which is called prapatti in devotional philosophy. Anugulyasya sangalpaha pratigulyasya varjanam rakshasiridhi vishwasaha goptrutta varanam tatha atmanikshepakarpanne sadvidha saranagati. So I have explained. Now, the question arises. Generally what happens, you know, when we read books, we feel, well, we must surrender ourselves completely to God. We do that, but our surrender may not always be complete. There is a difference in degrees in the completeness of surrender. That's an important factor. I can give us any, this can be explained in the light of an illustration. There was a great philosopher, was a Mimamsa philosopher, his name was Kumarila Bhatta. So he was a great exponent of the Vedas. Some atheist agnostics got angry with him and threw him over the cliff of a mountain. And as he was falling, he said, if Vedas are genuine, nothing will happen to him. So what happens, as he hit the ground, nothing happened to him, but only he became blind in one eye. Because the if clause was there. It was a conditional clause, so to speak. He didn't say Vedas are right, therefore nothing happens. No, nothing happened. He said, if Vedas are right, it's a conditional clause. So one eye, he became blind in one eye. So this happens in many cases. So nothing wrong in it. In fact, we may not be able to fully surrender. Even in the act of surrendering ourselves, there may be difference in degrees. Sometimes you find some great saints. Saint Augustine is an example, Saint Francis is an example, Valmiki is another example, many like that. Some of them had difficult times before their conversion. But they had one quality. They were, well, Valmiki was a robber, but a successful robber, absolutely uncompromising. Now what happens, you know, his obsession, he was so evil that when he was converted, he was converted completely. Saint Augustine, he was a very talented person, but was a worldly minded person. And his mother was praying for him. So in the confessions which I narrated yesterday, he gives a long description of how he underwent conversion. And when the transformation came upon him, he could not control his tears. He was shedding tears. And he thought he heard a voice coming from a home, which he interpreted as voice coming from God. And he interpreted that voice as an order to him to open the book, the Bible. And he opened the book, he found one sentence which he took as his motto in his life. So such things happened because they were so intense. Intensity is an important factor in real surrender, real conversion. So Girishchandra Ghosh was very intense. Total sincerity. So 100% sincerity. Sometimes we want to surrender, and we do, but it may not always be 100%. There is nothing wrong in it. See, Vedanta doesn't say you get 100% mark or you get zero. No. Even if you get 99%, even you get 1%, then also you can start your journey, you can make further progress. That's what I referred to in the 6th chapter of Gita. Arjuna asked this question. Suppose somebody meditates and prays and tries to surrender, resigning everything to God, but there is still conflicts, still doubts in mind. So what to do? And sometimes we get this wrong notion that if we make a mistake, immediately all the good things that we have done will be deleted. No. That's a problem in the concept of in some of the monotheistic religions, where if you commit one mistake, you are heading for hellfire, because you only one chance, one life. No, that's the point. Vedanta doesn't say that you try once and if you fail, you are disqualified. No. One can continue the journey. It doesn't mean that complacency is an option. No, we should not become complacent, but the idea of either 100% pass mark or nothing, that is wrong. We can slowly make progress. So I get it. That's why prayer has its own dynamics. That's why Vedanta says there is nothing wrong in praying for material benefits. Suppose you are sick. You pray to God, please cure me. No, I will not pray for that. I want complete realization or no prayer. That is wrong. Because Vedanta says, even if a devotee who has not reached the highest level of spiritual evolution, even if that devotee prays for solution for some of his problems in material life, sickness, you want to get cured, poverty, you want to get enough wealth to make both ends meet, like that, you know. Nothing wrong, because instead of knocking at the wrong door, you are praying to God after all. But that is not the highest form of prayer. That's the only thing. That is not the highest form of prayer. So that's why Ramanuja is a Vaishnava interpreter of Gita. He writes his commentary on the Gita sloka, Udara Sarvayaveyate. That's what it means. They are all these devotees, those who pray for remedy, for relief from illness, those who pray for material wealth because if you are poor, and those who pray for knowledge about God and do the highest. They are all noble-hearted because They are turning to God, not to anything else, for finding a solution. So even the idea of praying to God for material benefit is admitted in Vedanta, but it is not the highest form of prayer. It is not for the highest spiritual practice. It's not for the highest, the devotee of the highest order. Because once you pray for material benefit, and if you feel God has answered your prayers, solved your problems, then out of a sense of gratitude to God, you start praying without any desire for material benefits. So you pray with desire, and gradually you evolve to another level of spiritual evolution. You start praying without desire. So gradually evolves. So that's an important point of divergence between the popular monotheistic religions and Vedanta. Vedanta is universal. Vedanta has in his fold the highest devotee who want nothing but God. Who don't want anything other than God's grace. And also those who pray for ordinary things. But because we need kindergartens, we also need universities. We cannot exist just depending upon the universities. So that's why these four orders of spiritual seekers are explained in the Gita. That's the idea. So there may be difference in degrees with regard to surrender. When we take a strong decision, I am surrendering myself to God. It may work, but in some cases, we may not manifest the characteristics of a person who has surrendered himself to God. In some case, in some aspects, we may manifest those qualities, but no less. Nothing wrong in it. Slowly we will evolve, if not in this life, next life. Vedanta says, nothing is lost. Whatever little you practice, it will be deposited. It will not be lost. That's the idea.
I have a question. Sorry, Sajji. Is there you mentioned the wedding vow, the Christian wedding vow. And does the Veda support the idea of until death do we part?
Yeah, that's the thing. That's in the 10th mandala, 10th section of Rigveda, there is a famous hymn which runs into several verses, pretty long one. It is the name of the hymn itself, the particular section of the hymn is called Vivaha Suktam, a hymn on wedding, Vivaha wedding. So, one important part of it is, I take your hand with the assumption that you will be a participant, a sharer, the one who shares the burden of life for the whole life. It's a lifelong pilgrimage. Life, married life is depicted as a lifelong pilgrimage in which both the husband and wife play equal parts. That is ardha, means half of the burden is for husband, the other half for the wife. So it is called, the name, Vedic name for wife is Sahadharmini. The idea is this, the one who participates shares half of the burden for this pilgrimage, it is married life.
So it's just during that lifespan, that physical lifespan, it doesn't go beyond the lifespan?
Yeah, only physical life, yes, that's right. There's only the one life, yes.
Swami, you talked about samskaras and how, yeah, the example of, the 10 years, more things like that. In Vedic literature, is there any discussions, a little bit more than just sort of a theoretical thing, in the sense.
Yes.
Anything more than that.
Yes, Now, the sacrament is called in Sanskrit samskaras. So, total there are 16 sacraments mentioned. Sordesha samskaras. which begins with the conception, ending with the cremation of the body. Antyeshti and Garbhadhana Antyeshti. This is, between these there are 14 others. Now, all these are described in the Smriti literature, not in Vedas. These things are not described in the Vedas. They are described in the Smriti literature, Yajnavalkya, Parashara, Manu and other literatures. Actually, there are 14 sacraments mentioned in the Smriti literature, which are condensed into 16, common for all. It's like, you know, giving the name, eating food the first time, then the sacred thread ceremony, study of the Vedas, termination of the Vedic studies, marriage, and so on like that. So there are other, in the elaborate Vedic scheme, there are 40 sacraments mentioned, which is called samskaras, which are condensed into 16 prominent sacraments. They are all, these sacraments are not described in the Vedic literature, they are described in the Smriti literature, and other Apastamba, Ashwalayana, like that, many others.
Would you consider Sri Sarada Devi an avatara?
Yes. Because when we talk about avatara, we are talking about the bodily manifestation of the supreme impersonal reality. So, avatara itself means coming down, mean becoming embodied. The Brahman, which is beyond name and form and embodiment, appears to have become embodied. In Vedantic perspective, any great spiritual person who can transform others, who can embody the highest spiritual virtues like Jesus Christ, Buddha, they are all avatars. In Hindu or Vedantic perspective, Christ also is an avatar, incarnation. You find the writings of Vivekananda, writings of Swami Abhedananda, that you find.
What's the difference between a guru? Can they transform as well?
Guru become an instrument in the hands of God. Avataras come for the whole humanity. Gurus are individual. They can give guidance. They can just take you to the freeway. Then you should continue your journey. But that's all right. Yes, Guru is one who, technically Guru means a person who removes the darkness of ignorance from our heart. That's a real meaning. The Guru who gives us knowledge, light, by taking us to the spiritual path. If we follow the instructions of our teacher, Guru, with great care, great attention, then we'll reach our destination. But avataras come for the whole humanity. In Sri Ramakrishna's gospel, in the literature you find, Sri Ramakrishna compares avataras to a huge steamship. They take thousands of people up and down, and they continue doing that. But other teachers, well, they may take you in a small boat, and later that boatman may not return. He may stay there. But he may not function for the whole humanity. But the steamship company, they cannot remain on the other bank of the river. They have to come back again, take others again across. So avataras are great world teachers who come from time to time in different ages. Avataras come in cycles. They come for the whole humanity. They come from age to age. This idea began. Mostly gurus take up the great teachings of avataras and they interpret for the sake of individual spiritual seekers, taking them to the spiritual path. That's the function.
Exactly.
Yes. Avataras embody the essential teachings of the Vedas, the eternal teachings, which are for all people, all times, all ages. Individual gurus and teachers, they take up these teachings and ideas and instruct individual spiritual seekers, taking them to spiritual path. That's a different. Yes.
Swami, somebody told me that they believe that every Swami is a guru. This is what they considered. And I said in Vedanta that we consider the guru as the one who initiates you.
Yes, that's true. Now in Vedanta, that's concept, correct. But in the Dasanami order of monks, to which most of the present Hindu monastic institutions belong, every monk can be a potential teacher, but in different organizations and orders, these are regulated for the convenience of the organization. That's the idea behind. So, in Vedantic tradition, your guru is one who teaches you, who gives you instructions. That's the idea.
But is it all right to think of, for somebody to think of every Swami as a guru?
You should respect all. We should, but at the same time, every Swami. You should look upon your own teacher, the one who initiated you, as your guru. But you should respect and you should honor everyone. That's right.
Swami, this morning you talked about the five responsibilities of the household.
Yes.
And we had a lot of conversation about that, because one of the things I noticed is that it didn't relate to the raising of children, but it did relate to the protection of animals. So we thought that was a little strange.
No, that's yes, that's called Bhudayajna. Bhudayajna means you have to Pancha Mahayajna, five sacrifices, five rituals, yes. We must show honor to guests, and we must also show honor. We must honor the Vedic tradition, the saints and sages, by studying the Vedas, religious scriptures in each, according to, depending upon the tradition to which we belong. And Bhutayajna, this called, means we must be kind towards the animal kingdom. That's the idea.
But does it relate to children at all in our responsibility?
In Pancha Mahayajna, it is not included, because it is so understood. It is so well understood that there is no need to mention that. Yes. When we talk about showing honor to Vedic tradition, all people may not do that. But looking after their children, that's every parent, every mother and father supposed to do that. So there is no need to mention it.
Is there an easy way to distinguish samskaras, or quick way, samskaras and vasanas?
Oh, yeah. samskaras and vasanas, they're interrelated. Samskara is a tendency which springs from a modification, which again is related to an action. So we do something, whatever we do, or act, think or speak, will have an effect on the mind stuff. That becomes a tendency. Now, that tendency is in potential form. There is a possibility for that tendency to spring again under favorable circumstances. Now, this tendency becomes a strong action-oriented tendency, becomes more powerful. We are looking for an opportunity to act according to a potential tendency in our mind. then it becomes vasana. Vasana is nothing but a tendency which becomes action-oriented. Tendency by itself is a potential, is a potency. Is a potency. The same potency becomes action-oriented, then it becomes a vasana. To give an example, in some families, both parents may be musicians, a child may show a vasana to play violin or some musical instrument. Now, the tendency to study music is already there as a potency. But every day that child sees his or her parents practicing music, so he has an opportunity. So he has a tendency to implement that potency, that tendency, and he starts playing it. And he shows prodigious skills in that. So it becomes vasana. Vasana is nothing but a tendency which becomes action-oriented.
Yes. Vritti
is general. Vritti may not always become a tendency. Whatever we do, it creates an impact. That's called vritti. It's a modification. Vritti is inevitable, whatever we do, good and bad. Vasana may not be a vritti. See, vritti can be good or bad. For example, when we do something and something happens, if that result is pleasant, the vritti will tempt us to do it again. If it is not pleasant, then the vritti may tempt us to avoid that action. But when it becomes vasana, it is always related to a positive vritti which produces pleasant result. Positive action produces pleasant result.
So a vasana is always positive?
Yes. Vasana is, yes, because action oriented. You want to do something because you had done it earlier, it produced pleasant results, so you want to do it again.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes,
because
right.
You could do something negative and want to do
then,
it.
Then, yes, no. Nobody will. See, suppose something happened, you find a cat may hesitate when it sees cold water because it fell in hot water and it got burned. But a cat will not show a vasana to jump into hot water again. Because an unpleasant experience will not produce vasana. An unpleasant experience produces a vritti, a tendency to avoid it, but not a vasana. Vasana is a tendency to repeat action. Action-oriented tendency or potency is vasana. That tendency may not always be action-oriented. It could be oriented towards avoiding the action. Somebody did something unpleasant, an unpleasant result followed. It becomes a modification, and then it remains there, but it will not become action-oriented because he doesn't want to repeat that unpleasant result.
But that's with a healthy mind. There's people who repeat negative actions because...
Oh, yes, that's true. It's a pathological state. Yes. It's an unhealthy mind.
Okay.
That is true. People who consciously do things which they know will produce unhealthy, undesirable, unpleasant results. It's a pathological problem. We call them abnormal normally. Normal persons do not want to do such things, you know. That's how they be.
I always consider the samskara as something negative, something that...
Not always negative, yes.
Okay.
Negative samskaras do not become vasana. Positive samskaras become vasana. All of us have got negative and positive samskaras.
Oh, I see.
That's why people face problems when meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Negative samskaras emerge. Positive samskaras also emerge. When positive samskaras are predominant, you feel like enjoying meditation. You feel like sitting for a long time. you enjoy being in that meditative state of mind. But suddenly a negative samskara emerges, which comes in conflict with these positive samskaras. So that creates restlessness, jerking of the body. So you feel like coming, running away from the seat. Well, I won't go to Vedanta Society, you have enough of it. We may feel. But then again, we go to library, we read Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, we read Bible, we read great spiritual books. Then positive samskaras again are reinforced. So we start spiritual practice again. Again, when people move in undesirable company, who tell you, oh, it's all absolute gibberish, do nothing. Then again, what happens? This listening, this association produces negative samskaras. Again, we stop. That's why many people stop coming to Vedanta Society. Again, they re-emerge. It happens. That's why one important sutra of Patanjali is Sātu Dirghakāra Nairandarya Satkāra Asevido Dadabhumi. Okay, I'm finishing it now. Sātu Dirghakāra Nairandarya Satkāra Asevido Dadabhumi is a famous sutra in Patanjali. What Patanjali says is this. This spiritual progress or yoga can be reached, attained only by practicing for a long time without break, without cessation. But that is possible only if you love the spiritual ideal, if you have a liking for the spiritual practice. So, satkara means respect, reverence. So, we can practice we can do spiritual practice for a long time, with continuity, without break, with a relaxed mood, only if we have a liking for doing that. Otherwise, continuity and long practice could not be combined. You may do for a long time, but there will be occasional breaks. Or you may do for a short time, continually. But here it is said, continuity and for a long time you have to practice. Both can be possible only if you have a liking to practice meditation, spiritual practice. Then only yoga is possible. So that's the idea behind. Now, these negative samskaras will emerge and create gaps. But those negative samskaras can be neutralized, can be, used modern language, deleted. Intensity can be reduced by consciously practicing positive samskaras, positive ideas. By reading good books, listening to great spiritual ideas, by enriching the mind with spiritual food, more and more. That's the idea.
Swamiji, is it better to not to acquire any samskara compared to positive samskaras?
Hmm? Is it better?
Is it not our goal to have any samskaras? No, don't acquire any samskaras, positive or negative.
Yes. Before reaching that state, that is called vritti nirodha. Before reaching that state, we must fill our mind with positive vrittis. Before reaching vritti nirodha state, cessation of modifications, we must reach that state where we will have one strong, great vritti, which is essentially positive. Then only you can transcend it. So long as we are in a state of conflicts, we can never transcend. That's the idea. So, it's only 11:34, so we will have a short break and then meditation. And of course, we know from 12 to 12:30 meditation, 12:30 to 1, lunch preparation, 1 to 3 o'clock, lunch and cleanup. So, thank you. Namaskar. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.